Welcome, everybody. Today's session is, we've just got the G up from Martin Mulcair. Going to be exciting, involve lots of discussion and lots of different views. So I've tried to do my bit by putting out a few views that perhaps didn't concur with all of the views that we heard in the first plenary session, and hopefully don't concur with all of your views. I'd prefer it if you guys just ask questions along the way as they occurred to you, or as I inflamed you, hopefully, that we could have more of a discussion than just a presentation. So one of the problems with writing papers, which Peter and I were just discussing, is that they ask you to write a synopsis about 6 months before the conference. So I did write a synopsis about what I was going to do at the time, and basically it was going to be looking at some of my negative views of regulators and what I thought could be done about it, which included an investigation of ways to get around the regulation for retail financial services. I guess one of the problems with doing a bit of research and reflecting on things is that sometimes your mind gets changed. So, but basically, when you read the statement of intent of all the regulators and all that sort of stuff, they're all talking about wanting to get competition going and efficiency and aligning interests and all the stuff that I was sort of keen to talk about. So it kind of put a bit of a hole in my kind of plans to lambast the regulators. I guess I had to kind of think about it again, and in doing so, sort of came up with a bit more of a general view that the problems are more systematic, and we really need to just see regulators as one of the issues rather than the main problems that I was originally wanting to talk about. So, my view is sort of a little bit more that, the regulators are sort of a political convenience. The politicians kind of appoint regulators so they've got somebody to blame. And then, on the other hand, they tend to use them to say, oh, well, don't worry, you can feel reassured because we've got regulators here to look after things. But the reality is the regulator doesn't appear to be your friend. I think the regulator just looks at the law and tries to get on with their own business of surviving their political masters and the media. So, my general point is that structure is the real problem. Basically, you've got, right from the top, you've got the governments with the Senate as a house of review, but in the two-party system, the same people who are proposing bills are usually dominating the Senate and basically just ticking them off. Something I complained about a couple of years ago is company boards. They're basically supposed to be a review of company strategy, but these days you've got the CEOs and senior management on the company boards, and sure, they go to the trouble of stepping out when there's a discussion of remuneration or something like that, but essentially the way I see it, most of the CEOs are driving what's happening in the board rather than having a kind of a process of review. And I guess the topic that I'd originally chosen to focus on today, retail financial services, I think the structures there are just very, very much focused on the promoter paying themselves, paying their lawyers, paying the people to sell the product, and rarely the retail investor is left not in the best position, particularly if once investments go south. So I think there's a reality that we're not going to be able to change the political situation or the regulation industry, but I kind of think that there's an opportunity potentially to get some sort of grassroots support for new structures that that actually work more efficiently. I mean, clearly there's an internet which gives some opportunities, but it's hard to get airspace in the current world. So while there is that potential opportunity, it's hard to access it. So I guess I've always thought that if we could get some actuaries together and some actual support for better structures, then there's a chance of actually getting some momentum together and changing the industry from within by basically offering a better product. But as I said, there will be difficulties. So I think the summary of my kind of issue with the world is that it's run by confident people rather than competent people, and it may be a subjective call, but I tend to think that actuaries tend to fall into the competent category and therefore probably don't get as much of a say and as much influence as they probably deserve. And the idea of having better structures, better aligned structures, and more efficient structures is that over time there'll be there should be better rewards for competent people versus confident people. Well, just to explain it a bit more, I do get it that we all crave a bit of certainty. So the confident people do have something to sell. No child will live in poverty, and we have zero tolerance for misogyny or racism or sex or whatever it was that they had zero tolerance for in the army the other day. All these sort of confident statements that, when you break it down, they don't seem to, mean much or lead to much. One of the problems with the structures we've got, I think, is that, there's just sort of this, I've called it a cult of amorality, but it's probably a misnomer, because I think cult implies that it's, not a widely held sort of practice. So, I think we went from a world where there was good and evil, to a world dominated by lawyers, and basically the law is in Australia and England in particular is focused on an amoral approach. There's the law, and the US, I'm sure. So that's kind of filtered around everywhere, so that whatever you can get away with is okay. And I think a lot of the structures were probably worked a bit better in a world where there's a bit more of a sense of doing the right thing. The way I see it, the simple problems are the end justifies the mean, and most of the really really big losses come from people just making decisions about other people's money. And I've been working in America, as I said, it's just unbelievable the sort of way that cowboys operate, where I guess I've sort of think of it as the American approach, which is basically the end justifies the means. If I just go in and do something and can get away with it for long enough and make enough money, then when they catch the regulators or the authorities catch up with me, I'll just throw money at them and I'll start contributing to political parties and it shouldn't be a problem. And you just see that sort of approach happening there, and I think it's sort of spreading around the Western world. And I mean, there's clearly a general problem with governments and executives in these huge corporations these days just playing with other people's money as though the main concern was to get them re-elected or to feather the nest or something like that. So basically I'm suggesting that the problems aren't really regulator problems or problems that are going to be solved by having a regulator waving a stick or a flag around. They run a bit deeper than that. And I think as a result of that, everyone seems to put all their energies into the symptoms. Well, particularly governments, I guess, when they're just focused on media and polling and all the rest of it. So they're just basically in a reactive mode. So instead of trying to address the underlying structure, making things, setting things up so that they'll work better, people tend to focus on symptoms, and that's probably a little bit of a positive view of it, because there's probably an argument that some poor structures actually suit the drivers involved, and they made reference in the last meeting to some of those chief executives getting huge bonuses while the companies are losing money and all that sort of stuff. Why would you want to change any of that? And I don't know if any of you saw that movie, The Inside Job, but it was about the global financial crisis, basically it seemed like a lot of the people on the Fed Reserve were kind of admitting that they hadn't done it right, and all the regulators were basically ex-Goldman chiefs and all that sort of stuff. So there was didn't seem to be a nice simple line between who was regulating and who was being regulated. In fact, the bailing out of AIG, I guess, was highlighted as a way to quickly pay Goldman's $20 billion or something, 100 cents in the dollar for AIG credit default swaps, when there was clearly, in those circumstances, an opportunity to do a little bit of negotiation and get that sort of number down. And I mean, even before you go there, there's the question about whether Goldman's should have been rewarded for one, creating all those risks; two, selling them; and then three, overselling them so that they had all this upside out of the misery that they basically participated heavily in creating. Anyway,
can I ask a question?
Sure. I would very greatly appreciate it.
Sure. It's John Bayliss from Westpac, and you've talked a lot about Goldman's being the creators of some of these risks, and the regulators probably being in their pocket somewhat. What about Lehman's? Why did they let Lehman's fail in that case?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. At the time that Lehman's failed, somebody told me it was because they'd They were basically owned by people of Jewish extraction, but you'd think Goldman's, or with a name like Goldman's, that might not be the perfect kind of answer. The simple answer is I don't know, but there's obviously an incredible amount of pressure and negotiating and all sorts of things going on at the time, and my suspicion is that it was just a question of we might have to compromise here and let somebody go down. We want to we've got closer links with these guys, and as I understand it, AIG, which was the credit behind those credit default swaps, the $600 billion or whatever it was. I think that they had a lot of their those credit default swaps were owned by European banks, which I think the European central banks had told them to cut down their exposures and take out a bit more of that debt. So I think there was pressure from Europe to kind of get AIG back, but that fitted in nicely with supporting their mates at Goldman's. The Lehman's guys were basically in the same sort of business, but in Australia they sold it to local governments, so wasn't the first thing that they were worried about. But I'm sure a lot of investors got hurt, but it was probably just part of a compromise. Some people don't want us to support anybody, and other people want us to support everybody, and we got trying to put together packages for this and that. So I suspect it was just part of that sort of political compromise. At the dinner last night, Melinda suggested that one of the things actuaries had to offer was a passion for fairness, and one of the things that she'd observed amongst most of her actuarial colleagues was this passion, and I guess I've got to admit that that's something that I think I'm stuck with. I guess I've sort of tried to say in the past that I think one of the sort of skills that actuaries should be selling is their skills with issues of equity and between different parties and over time and over generations, which obviously a kind of core competency that we've all studied over the years. I'm sort of generally trying to kind of lean on that core competency and suggest that there's we can use that to create solutions in different areas. And 2 years ago I talked about different corporate structures. Today I was going to focus on retail financial services. But 2 years ago we didn't actually get through the whole process of the problem and the solution and where I was going. So this year I was just going to try and quickly identify the problem and hopefully just have a general discussion about whether actuaries should be focusing on trying to address what I see as the real problems, which is the structure, or whether we should put all our energies into risk management and being, as I see it, part of the problem. Because they did talk in the plenary session about how the risk manager was going to be independent in in the new rules, but you know, when he's hired by somebody further up the organisation, I think evidence and history sort of suggests that independence kind of only counts for so much. So with retail financial services, I guess the issue is do financial service regulators regulate the providers, or do they simply limit investor choice and return? And in my paper, I'd put together a couple of graphs to try and demonstrate why I sort of think that the regulator does more to limit the choice of the retail investor than promote good product. So I guess in this this compliance cascade, I would have done a compliance wheel of death, except my PowerPoint skills weren't up to it. We start with the compliance cost and burden, and basically that creates this sort of imperative to either centralise your compliance or outsource it completely. And I've talked to a few people. Yeah, you can buy a retail financial service licence to set up a fund for $125,000 a year or something like that. And if you just want to sell to wholesale investors, it'll probably only cost you $75,000 a year. But basically, or else you can pay a lawyer, and they often quote you sort of $25,000-$30,000 to get your financial services license. So, I mean, basically, this compliance system seems to me to be focused on creating an industry, creating jobs for everybody, which I guess is also what the risk management industry is all about, which arguably is a good thing for the profession. Once you start creating a centralised compliance specialist area, then they start deciding we need bureaucratic processes of risk aversion. Everybody has to fill out their form about whether they enjoyed the presentation or not, regardless of what they wanted to do next, or need to visit the ladies or gentlemen. So, these things just follow naturally, and if you have people in an isolated environment and their role is to ensure compliance, then they'll tend to create extra reports and extra things to do, and just that whole process makes it harder and harder for anybody small and innovative to come in and compete. Then you end up with very little competition and high costs and high fee products. And the problem with high cost and high fee products is that you want to make money out of it, so you need to actually sell quite a lot of it to make money out of it, which means you have to pay big commissions or incentives to people, which means that you tend to compete on fees rather than on product, and just because of that whole environment, you end up with pretty standard structures and need to avoid risk, because you don't actually want to spend 3 or 5 years building up a beautiful big clientele and a big fund be taking risks that are different from what the other people are doing. So, as Hazel Leach referred to in the wholesale area, you end up having everybody looking over their shoulder and making sure they're doing what the other guy is doing. Not necessarily because it's good for the investor, but because it's good for protecting their butts. So, result. Very little competition and high cost fees and products. So, how do you get about that? Well, as I sort of mentioned earlier, you can maybe try to offer new products, and I have started and try and get around regulation. But, I mean, it's very hard to get around regulation now, although you wouldn't think so when you listen to the radio and they've got somebody coming along and saying, I'm a plumber and I make thousands of dollars on trading foreign exchange and ring up and all that sort of stuff. How's that stuff happening when you know, some little guy who wants to set up a genuine fund that adds value and has low fees can't get a foot in? Well, it does. I guess I've got a general fear that that most of this regulation, because it's a money orientated thing, you pay your money, you get your badge from the regulator. I'm regulated. Now I can sell to anybody. I'm regulated. When things go wrong, the regulator didn't know that they were going to invest second mortgages rather than mortgages or whatever. They were just worried that they ticked off all the boxes in the first place. So my analysis of some of the issues with the objectives of regulation and the outcomes is that regulators are driven by fear, and that's the way that it's been set up. I don't think they had much say in that. So they make some awful decisions, and I definitely have been involved and know of quite a few things which I was originally going to spend some time talking about. But they make bad decisions in poor situations because typically they don't find out that something's wrong until half the assets are gone or whatever. So then because every time that happens and they get presumably near full out of somebody who's unhappy, they feel like they need to have more processes in place, which in the end I don't think will solve any of the issues of fraud or incompetence. I guess the jury's out on incompetence. I think it is possible for a regulator to kind of make some judgment about competence of people, but pretty hard to make any judgment about the intentions of people. So they're driven by fear, and that's how they work. The structures that are created are driven by promoters, and they're driven by greed. So obviously the promoter wants as much money as they can get out of it, and all the lawyers and sales guys along the way are happy to participate in that. So the interesting thing is that it would actually probably work an awful lot better if structures or promoters were driven by fear, because then a fear that they're going to lose money for their investors, because then basically they'd be aligning their interest a bit more. And my personal belief is regulators, if they were driven by greed a bit more, that wouldn't be a bad thing either, because there'd be a bit more attempt to get a market that works nicely and is flourishing and growing rather than an attempt just to fill out as many forms as we can. So one of the big outcomes is of this sort of regulation of retail financial service, I think, is that you haven't got a lot of competition. But I got carried away on one slide with my PowerPoint skills. So there's a question mark about what is competition, because we've obviously got a competition commissioner and a competition regulator. And I saw Graham Samuel was retiring the other day, and the article in the paper said that he'll be remembered as a cartel basher. I kind of read that and thought, I'm certainly not going to remember him that way. You just imagine that was the line he's feeding the guy in the media, who probably didn't know much better, and that there it is, it's on paper, so, you know, he's a competition basher. But, cartel basher. Yeah, sorry. Freudian mistake there. But, obviously he's been asked over his time to look at the supermarkets and the banks, and never found too many problems with the banks, and neither has he with the supermarkets, as far as I can tell. And it seems to me like there are problems with competition in those areas. But when I thought about it a bit more, so it sort of gets a bit down to, what is competition? And, certainly in that banking industry, there's this sort of four pillars starting point, which means that, in the end, you can have, very strong competition between four players that are basically offering the same thing. And you could argue that that's very strong competition, but there might not be like much innovation there because they're all basically going to be trying to do the same thing. But it is competition. So I sort of think that the competition regulator could, I don't think I read their statement of intent, but I'm sure it's got innovation and promoting innovation in there somewhere. Everyone else seem to have that, the ASIC and APRA kind of sites. I think I did try in the paper to go through and explain the circle that happens, which regulation and compliance weakens small players and new entrants, small players forced to close or merge, and certainly anecdotally I'm hearing that APRA's running around trying to close down all the credit unions, the small credit unions, or make them merge. So at the same time as we're looking for that elusive more competition in financial services, the regulators are actually trying to get rid of it. Trying to get rid of the small players, basically, because there's more chances of them going wrong.
Makes the job easier.
Yeah. But you get rid of all the small players, charges tend to rise, and then you see the big players becoming more powerful, mopping up the remaining players, which I guess has all been happening in the banking world, which all the politicians are theoretically worried about and talking about, but in practice they're not really doing anything about it. So regulators demand competition between big players, and the big players sort of wave their wands and show that they're they've got lots of competitive products with each other, but as I said earlier, they're all the same products. So, certainly the banking industry, the supermarket industry sort of ends up being dominated by, a few players. And there's not a lot of innovation there. Why should we care? Well, we probably shouldn't, but, my earlier point was that as actuaries, and my subjective view that actuaries tend to be more competent than the average person out there, we should be trying to promote a world in which the competent people are rewarded rather than the confident people. So that's the close to the heart reason why we should care. I mean, as Melinda said, we've got a passion for fairness. So as actuaries, that's the. I guess that's pretty close to the heart too, but I mean the bigger picture is that we'd probably be better off if we lived in a world where there was a better allocation of resources and more efficiency, and we could have less children living in poverty, or some of the goals that that our politicians talk about. So, what can be done? Well, there's the million-dollar question. But I wasn't going to go to that part two of getting around the cost of regulation in the retail financial services. Because, as I said, two years ago, I ended up not getting very far. But essentially, my argument, which I'm very happy to get views on, is that it is possible for better structures to be set up where interests are better aligned, that have credibility. I mean, it's... I've already said it, but it is a hard thing to sell credibility. You know, when you're following behind the confident people who, are 100% certain they're going to, make the world better, have the best healthcare system in the world, have the best transport system in the world, and they're going to do it in 100 days and all the rest of it. So, best schooling system in the world. Don't you worry about that. Coming along behind them and saying, "Oh, look, we'll create a slightly better retail funds for you," is a difficult act. The current situation is sort of, creating a lot of strains, and as actuaries, I think we're kind of aware that health costs are only going to go up, and various other costs are going to go through the roof. So there's sort of long term issues of sustainability, and I'm probably not quite as positive as Hazel about the world's ability to solve all these things at the same time. Although clearly there's been a record of innovation as things have been needed, but we seem to be constantly backing ourselves into, well, our politicians and leaders seem to be constantly backing us into this situation where there's less scope for or less margin for error going forward. So yeah. You know, the odd natural catastrophe on top of some social unrest and all the rest of it is going to create problems. So in my mind, sustainability and some sort of inspiration is going to be a part of solving the problems. And anyway, that's where I was going to finish my chat. So I'm very, very happy to take any questions, and next time around I'll have a retail fund going myself, which hopefully I'll be able to get a few people interested in investing in. So thanks very much.
Peter, I'd love to hear.
Instructions.
Okay, it works. Eric, I'm very grateful for your paper. In a profession where most of the people seem to default to supporting regulation, it's, in my view, very healthy to have a counter view put. And in fact, to some extent, the views that you put reflect those that I have come to over many, many years of observation of the cycle of economics and
we may have had one too many glasses of wine together.
Well, I don't know who influenced whom the most.
I'm sure you can take credit for most of it.
Well, I wouldn't say that. What we're talking about here is the interaction between populist democratic politics and Darwinistic economics. And all of the issues that brings up, and one of them is, in my view, that the institute itself has no place in that debate. The individuals do, but not the institute. And the institute does, from time to time, tend to make that mistake, in my view, and I've always been against that. But I think we as individuals can. I mean, actuaries, you know, tend to make money out of regulation, and they tend to see that as the first place where they should go and make money, rather than involving themselves in the Darwinistic world and of economics. And I know that that's, you've been more on that second camp in your career, and I think that's good. Ronald Reagan famously said, the scariest thing that you could ever hear someone say is, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. And that was a very famous, I think he did actually say it. Regulation has a number of features to it. First of all, its fundamental objective is to maximise votes for the politicians in a democratic society, and presumably to avoid revolutions in non-democratic societies. The costs it imposes, if you look at the cost-benefit, so far as the suppliers that are being regulated are concerned, the costs fall on the good guys who get virtually no benefits out of it, and nor do their customers. The benefits in the main, I'll talk about later, but no matter what costs are imposed on the bad guys, it's generally the benefits they get from being bad far outweigh any costs that they do. So its net effect is to impose costs on all the good guys, and generally it's not capable. The regulators, if they were smart enough to outsmart the bad guys, they wouldn't be regulators. They'd be out there in the marketplace.
Can I ask, does anyone else want to have a comment so I can make sure that they have a say before the end of the session?
Oh, we've still got reasonable time. We haven't heard any bells or anything.
I won't be long. The product of regulation is political security for the supposed product.
Yeah.
The long-term costs that are imposed actually undermines the self-reliance of the people in the market, and they actually come to rely upon the regulator instead of looking out for their own welfare.
Yeah.
So that's the cost. Now, like all command economy solutions, there are benefits, but they're short-term, and the costs are long-term. So what happens is the benefits basically keep fading away while the costs keep accumulating. And so then you get a Reagan comes along and says, we've had enough of this, or a Thatcher, and just wipes a whole lot away, and the cycle starts again. And in fact, it's very interesting that the global financial crisis has actually stimulated another round of this particular cycle. And, of course, those of us that are old enough to remember previous cycles know where it all ends up, but it's very interesting to listen to the younger people that are less experienced.
Not only the young, I think Desmond said that it's changed the world forever, regulation, but I think, you know, all that sort of stuff happened going into 1929. Let's loosen the belts and big crash, let's tighten it up, and then let's loosen again. So I agree with you.
Well, I'm going to mention four famous economists. Adam Smith, of course, who pointed out that people could be totally immoral at the micro level, but the macro outcomes could still be good. I mean, he was the first economist to point that out. A lot of people forgot it. Friedrich Hayek, of course, who lived under both, you know, lived in the 30s and 40s and saw both the Nazis and the Soviets and planning and all of that stuff. But he was unpopular with the German. He spoke German, but he's unpopular with the Germans because he was an Austrian. He's unpopular with the English because he spoke German. And, of course, they all embraced John Maynard Keynes, who was the great advocate of the command economy solution, you know, command economies and so on.
And in the current world, he was probably unpopular with the women if he wasn't attractive.
Well, notice that Kevin Rudd sort of gave him another serve. So he was out of his time. He was eventually recognised and got the Nobel Prize. But he dealt with all of this stuff very effectively 60, 70 years ago. Milton Friedman happened, he's the fourth one I'll mention, his timing was very good. He was there when Thatcher and Reagan were there. And of course, there was massive deregulation. And no matter what they now say, the global financial crisis did get a lot of poor people into housing who did not. jingle their keys and leave. They actually did very well out of it. But all the focus is on the small, relatively small percentage of those people.
The last wave.
Yes, who did badly. But the Thatcherite-Reagan period has given us this massive 30 years or whatever, where more people have probably been lifted out of poverty than at any other time in human history. But nevertheless, the problem is that you've got this populist short-term view, and with the Darwinist thing. The last thing I want to say is that, yes, I agree with you that regulation should be confined to structure issues. We've got it now in the health insurance situation when we have mutuals competing with for-profits, and I think that's very good. We saw the last when the NRMA went out of the general insurance market here in Australia. I think that was a great tragedy because the last mutual disappeared, and the result is that the structure can't now be regulated properly, in my view, in the absence of that variety. So I agree with you that the regulation of structure is probably useful, but not much else. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. As usual, you say everything so much better than I could. And I appreciate your thoughts. And I think one of the reasons that individuals struggle is, and the Institute maybe puts up its hand, is that feeling of helplessness. And I think we all probably succumb to it too easily. Even if I'm a very stubborn person by nature, I will eventually succumb to the fact that nobody's interested in anything I've got to say. I was actually hoping that the Institute would get a little bit involved at some stage and maybe push something forward that I couldn't push forward, but. Maybe these things just don't happen. And I think you commented about the rewards of regulation, and I think that was a good comment because basically by nature actuaries are probably generally a little bit conservative, so there is that focus on if we get a regulatory role that locks us into to getting a decent wage, and then we can be big actuaries and get a nice living, but in getting a nice living, it sort of maybe cuts off those opportunities. And I think somebody said earlier this morning that the average income of the actuaries who never actually made it to be actuaries. Was much higher than the average income of actuaries, and that's probably related to the kind of clinging to a bird in the hand, I suppose, versus two in the bush.
Hi, Mark Henderson from Zurich Financial Services. I thought your talk was very refreshing. So
thank you.
Some great views there. You touched on risk management and compliance, and in my experience, I've seen one of them swamp the other, and that's the compliance swamping the risk management function. And I was interested in your thoughts around what makes a good risk manager avoid becoming swamped by the compliance side of things. Thanks.
Yeah. That's a very difficult question, but I think in a practical day-to-day sense, the reality is that most of us get swamped by the little stuff. The wife's in the ear about getting home at 5:30 because there's something on. There's various other little things going on, and compliance can tend to be sort of once we get to the end and tick off all these things, then job's done, whereas risk management is a little bit more of an ongoing, less defined process. So I can sit here and think, what risks have we got, and write a list of five risks. I could sit there for another hour and maybe come up with two more. But and maybe that's far more important than ticking off all the boxes on the compliance side. But I mean, if I don't tick off all the boxes on the compliance side, I'm in trouble. If I don't identify a few extra risks that really are quite important, probably there'll be no consequences from it. So because there's nobody there to say, oh well, you didn't spend enough time on risk management. So I mean, that's my kind of immediate response. I guess I've sort of probably taken a pretty simplistic view of risk management and compliance, and I apologise for you or anybody else who's involved in those areas.
My name's John Dodsworth from MetLife. I just have a quick question. Is there any core component, core aspect of the current regulatory environment that does work? And if we could redesign everything, would there be some core components that we'd want to keep?
Thank you. I think there's definitely parts of regulation that are useful and that probably do work. It's just that if you're sort of sit there and go, okay, well, let's scrap everybody in this department and move them over to that department, then I think things end up not changing. But I mean, essentially, I've got absolutely no problem with the idea that that you should be setting standards for how much information you give retail investors and disclosure requirements and various other things. But it seems to me that what happens in practice, and this gets back to that sort of issue of amorality, is that lawyers tend to sort of go, okay, well, here's the requirement in words. Oh yeah, well, if we write 100 pages here and bury the bad stuff on page 77, no one will ever read it, which is right. And the financial advisor sort of has 10 documents with 100 pages, and he looks at the one pager that says, oh, that gives me a 5% commission, and that gives me a 3% commission, and that probably drives most of his kind of asset allocation kind of decisions. So I guess when I sort of looked at it, I sort of say, well, okay, they're doing a lot of things that make sense. Certainly their objectives are right. They're trying to get more competition. They're trying to get transparency. They're trying to do all sorts of things, get efficiency and cut costs. But why isn't it happening? And then you look at the things that they're doing. Yeah, well, they're trying to make sure there's good people in the business. They're trying to that all makes sense. But it's just That's why I kind of stepped back and said, well, there's a bit bigger problem here. We've just got this sort of amorality gap where the promoters are just saying, okay, well, I can see what they're trying to make us do, but how can we get around it and still fit in legally with that? Or, as I said, in the States, maybe not even bother. Let's just get around it, make lots of money and make some political contributions. If the investment goes well, nobody's going to complain. And if it goes badly, then we've got plenty of money in the pocket to fight legal battles.
Mike Murphy from Aon Hewitt, where my knowledge base is all about APRA regulation and ASIC as far as the others concerned, nothing about the light industry product area. counter view potentially to your scenario.
Great.
Which is that in the absence of regulation, the bad guys, there's going to be more of them and they're going to win more often. And I think so that's the difficulty of the problem that we're facing, is that it's quite clear that the good guys lose out of lots of regulation. And it's equally quite clear that the amendment of regulation doesn't actually stop the really bad guys, or doesn't stop the sort of slightly bad guys, because they're caught very late. But in the absence of regulation entirely, or in, even if you bring it back to certain principles, you end up with this nasty problem we have in society at large, is there's lots of bad people out there. And perhaps there's more of them out there as a proportion today than there used to be.
Yeah, and yeah, that's the amorality problem. But, I mean, I was thinking of suggesting that we don't need regulators at all, because we've already got laws, and we just need the laws to be hardened up so that, you know, you have proceeds of crime and type of laws. You have a lot more flexibility in laws. I mean, what's happened is laws have become codified, So the Tax Act ended up that thick. And so every time they put in a new provision to counteract something, then the tax lawyers spend half an hour, a few days, trying to work out how they can use that to create another opportunity. But the tax department's actually, you know, become better than most government departments by having, you know, Part 4A type of provisions, which say, you know, if you do something in order to be bad, then you're going to be slammed. And so I mean, there's definitely a possibility of, you know, focusing a little bit more on a legal system that takes out bad people and penalises bad people. But, I mean, again, you know, we do have problems in a politically charged environment with the compassion that we tend to show for sinners, you know, be they football players or others. Obviously, we need to be more compassionate for football players because of all the stresses and high salaries that they have to suffer. But I mean, in general, the system that we've built up, the legal system, is focused on, you know, obviously trying to rehabilitate and help people rather than to actually create some of the fears that people might have in you know, some of the more totalitarian societies, or in you know, societies, you know, a few hundred years ago, where you know, you do the wrong thing and you're gone. But yeah, I mean, I think when you actually sort of have those sort of the discussions that they had earlier about institutions that are too big to fail, you can't have those without having a regulator or supervision. So there's definitely some regulatory roles that are kind of you know, vital, and I'm certainly not expecting not proposing a world without regulators altogether. Just saying that in my humble opinion, the regulation industry is probably getting a bit too much good press out of the global financial crisis. And yeah, in fact, 2 years ago, there was a session on how well the Australian regulators had done. As far as I could see, and maybe it's reflected in comments about South Africa as well, you know, the Australian regulators are regulating banks and who've got most of their assets sort of buried in retail prime mortgages that basically lend. Well, I've heard some inside sort of views that, you know, the average loan to value ratio is sort of in the 60% range. So with the sort of property price movements, you know, their core assets haven't moved at all. And obviously, in the States, one of the big issues was, you know, and Ben Bernanke's sort of saying, you know, it's just never happened that
that you've had a downward movement in property prices across all the states. So all the models that have said, oh, well, even if it falls heavily in one state, don't worry, it'll be compensated for, there'll be some compensation from rises in other states. And then, so then when you have an average fall of 40% in the property prices across the states, and obviously some much bigger ones, 70% or something in Florida, I think it was, that takes banks out. But, I don't think we're going to get away from regulators, so please don't panic.
And the other last minute question has to be really quick, otherwise we'll wrap up there. Eric, you've given us some very provocative and frank discussions, and we certainly hear a lot of views today. So thank you very much for your speech, for your thoughts and your paper, but also for your contribution to the session.
Thank you. Thank you.